Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Yaron Brooks Show. This is my weekly news briefing. We'll be doing one today and one tomorrow. And a bunch of stuff to talk about. You know, Richard Spencer has come out against Jordan Peterson. Perfect. Trump administration has a new healthcare plan or a new healthcare tweak out. U.S. is going to sell nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. Anybody think that's a good idea? And Elizabeth Warren giving a speech about Native American heritage, Pocahontas. Some news about Brexit and Oxfam. Got to talk about Oxfam, the big charity. And, you know, if we have time, we'll talk about Syria and Chinese strippers. All right, hope you're all having a good week. I certainly am. And let's see, let's start off with with Oxfam. This is a story to come out of the UK. Oxfam is one of the largest charities in certainly in Great Britain, maybe in the world, certainly one of the most visible, one of the most vocal, huge on inequality. I was looking at some headlines that have kind of Oxfam as their as the centerpiece, and it really it's they have made inequality their issue. So you know, they report about the 62 wealthiest people have as much money as I don't know the rest of mankind, and 85 richest people as wealthy as the poorest 3 billion. Every few months they come up with these pearls of wisdom in terms of inequality. And you know, they send people around the world, and they supposedly help the poor, and they dish out money, and they holier than thou organization. Well, it turns out that they're going through this massive sex scandal right now. So it turns out that when they sent relief aid to Haiti during the earthquake aftermath of the earthquake, where about 100,000 people died. In 2011, and Oxfam raised huge amounts of money and sent many people over there to relieve, I guess, the hunger, the starvation, the problems. By the way, if you're interested in all of that and the some relief is good, but the kind of relief that turns into damaging relief, there's a wonderful documentary called Poverty Inc. Look it up, Poverty Inc. It's on Netflix. It used to be on Netflix. It's perfect, and they don't necessarily talk directly about Oxfam, but they talk about Haiti after 2011 and all the damage that was done during that relief effort to the prosperity and the ability of Haitians to be successful. Anyway, during this relief effort in 2011, it turns out that Oxfam had rented a large house to house some of the Oxfam, workers, these relief workers, and it turns out that this home was used for massive sex parties with prostitutes. So they, I guess, this was their attempt to invigorate the Haitian economy by injecting money. Money is one thing they were injecting into the Haitian economy by paying prostitutes. And suppose these were wild parties that many people participated in. Ultimately, after the headquarters got complaints, they had a whole investigation. They discovered, and they forced four people to resign. They were dismissed for gross misconduct. Oxfam director in Haiti resigned along with two other people. But they buried the report and they buried the whole story. And these people then went on to get jobs in other relief organizations without any warning that these people were, you know, irresponsible, crazy nuts using the charity's money that you all thought when you gave money to earthquake relief in Haiti, you all thought was going to actually relieve, actually help people, and actually was paying for sex parties with prostitutes in Haiti. You know, not, you know, this isn't an important story, but it's just these holier than thou, you know, supposedly altruistic. They play on altruism. What they really get kicks out of is the power that helping other people provides, the money that they get to spend, the money that they get to consume. I'm sure these organizations are unbelievably corrupt, but only for-profit organizations can be corrupt. You can't be corrupt as a non-for-profit, but I bet you they are. And it's just the whole attitude of these organizations complaining about corporate America, complaining about profits, complaining about inequality, complaining about capitalism. And you know, they, you know, I keep using this term that I learned it from Amy Peacock, scumbags, you know, filled with scumbags, right? I knew the term before Amy, but, you know, Amy gave me permission to use it publicly, I guess. Something like that. You know, so scumbags at these agencies. And I would just say, you know, sometimes giving money and contributing money to when there's some good cause, helping some people who are being hurt by no fault of their own and so on, is a good thing. But just be aware of who you're giving the money to. Just be aware of how that money is going to be used. I would not give a dime ever to Oxfam, not because of the sex parties, not because of the use of prostitutes, assumed using the company money, but because, and I wonder what the salaries of these guys are. I wonder how much these people make. But because of how their whole political agenda and their whole attitude towards inequality and their whole attitude towards capitalism, their whole attitude towards the wealth that is created that is then contributed to them for them to use as they see fit, and we can see how they now. It turns out that since then there have been 26 cases around sexual abuse, different types of sexual issues within Oxfam that Oxfam is currently investigating. 16 of those cases are linked to their international programs. I mean, just imagine these mostly guys going off to all kinds of places in the world, poor places, with basically suitcases full of money, and you know, and then nobody's and then nothings, and they're power hungry, and they've got money. Of course, they despise money because they're anti-money. These are good altruistic socialist warriors, right? And you know, this is what they do with the money. You know, there are plenty of good-looking women who will jump on them for a few bucks because a dollar goes a long way in poor places. It's just so disgusting and despicable. Anyway, I thought I'd share that gem of a story. Talk about gems, right? Richard Spencer. You know Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer is this alt-right racist. I don't know if he's the one who did the when he spoke right after the election. He got the Heil Hitler salutes. He was at Charlottesville. He's a real another scumbag. This is a really useful word, Amy. We, you know, really, really helpful. A really, really bad guy, right? And he's a big proponent of you know, white supremacists and separation of the white race from all other races and the whites establishing their own country and all this garbage. I mean, a real racist, a real horrible human being. And unfortunately, you know, if you go on Twitter, the guy has 80,000 followers. 80,000. I only have 17. He has 80,000 followers. I mean, that tells you something about the world we live in, right? I think. I mean, maybe I'm overestimating my value, but it tells you something about the world we live in when a scumbag like Richard Spencer has 80,000 followers and rational people advocating for what? For, you know, the horrible ideas of liberty, freedom, the awful ideas of reason and rational self-interest. You know, I only get 17,000. You know, that's where we are. Anyway, instead of complaining about the number of followers I have. Anyway, Richard Spencer, you know, used to like Jordan Peterson, and now he doesn't. Now he doesn't. Peterson hit a wall, he writes, and became shallow when he, one, refused to confront the racial issue. No, I think Peterson's confronted it, just not to Richard Spencer's liking. Good for Jordan Peterson. And two, became a clean up your room self-help guru. He could have been radical. He ended up as a conservative. Now, it's true that Peterson is too conservative and not radical enough on the right issues. But thank God, Jordan Peterson is not radical in the Richard Spencer sense. And actually, you know, it's good that Jordan Peterson, and I wish Jordan Peterson actually stuck to the things he knows about. I think his clean up your room self-help stuff is probably the best stuff he has. And, you know, when he dabbles in philosophy, when he dabbles in economics, he's not very good. But when he focuses on a kind of the self-help psychological stuff, he is much, much better. That's his real strength. That's the real good stuff. So good for Jordan Peterson for sticking to that. And yay! Richard Spencer hates you, Jordan Peterson. You know, maybe to some extent the enemy of my, if Spencer hates you, then you're probably okay. Oh, that probably doesn't apply because there's probably a bunch of people Spencer hates that I hate too. But I hate the thought of that. I hate having anything in common with that guy. But anyway, if you're interested in my opinions about the alt-right, I did a show probably about a year ago now, but maybe a year and a half ago, about the alt-right. And I encourage you. Yeah, it's a year and a half ago. Go listen to that. So it was actually a really good show. I ripped the alt-right to shreds because there were a bunch of really, really bad people. Irrational. Immoral. All right. Let's see. What was the... Okay, so that was Oxfam. Cross off the list. Richard Spencer. Cross off the list. Trump administration came out today with... some positive news, and that is that they are going to offer. So Republicans have failed dramatically, failed criminally, failed pathetically, you know, failed to repeal Obamacare and actually replace it with a free market alternative. I mean, they've really, it's pathetic how both the Trump administration and the Republicans in the House and Senate have failed to do this and will not try to do it again. Because for at least another year is my guess, because they need 60 votes for it. They could have got it by 51 votes, at least a piece of it, but they couldn't do that. They couldn't get their act together. And Trump, you know, Trump failed. Anyway, what they're trying to do at Health and Human Services is chip away at it. So they're trying to do whatever they can administratively to kind of offer alternatives to it. And that's a good thing. So today they announced that they are going to allow what they're calling the short-term policies. Short-term meaning up to 12 months that individuals can buy, not in exchanges, off of exchanges, and that they don't have to abide by all the regulations that the insurance policies on the exchanges have to abide by. So one of the problems, one of the big problems with Obamacare, and one of the problems with a lot of state regulations of health care, is that insurance companies can only offer certain types of insurance plans. Insurance plans that cover acupuncture and psychological care and pregnancy and birth control and a million things, whether you want them or not, whether you want them on out. And that makes them very expensive because they cover more than you need. And you're paying for stuff you don't need. So it makes it expensive relative to your actual needs. And people today are paying well over $1,000 for health insurance a month. These insurance policies, these new insurance policies, which the Democrats have called junk insurance because they don't meet their paternalistic know-it-all. I know what you want. I know what you need. I want to know what you have to have in kind of paternalism, paternalistic policies. So that the Democrats have called them junk insurance. So what the Trump administration is proposing is to allow companies to offer these trimmed down, slimmer, offering less coverage, but much cheaper insurance policies that will actually be more like insurance. For example, they'll rate you and you'll pay based on how healthy you are. If you're more inclined to use the insurance, you will actually have to pay more. So this is all good stuff, right? One of the, you know, they're so inconsistent. Now, to make this plausible, these insurance policies should be renewable, but they might not be allowed to be renewable, or they might not be the option of renewable just because, I don't know, because this is how it used to be. So there's still a lot of tinkering that needs to be done with. They're opening this up to public comment. Hopefully they'll get a lot of free market people commenting on how to make these even better and how to deregulate even more. But all of this is just tinkering at the edges until they actually come up with comprehensive health insurance reform that not only repeals Obamacare, but that offers a real alternative to Obamacare, a fundamental shift towards free markets in healthcare, which would require the government to get out of the health insurance completely, completely. All right. So, you know, some good news, a little bit of good news. As I said, at the regulatory level, the government is slowly on the edges, on the margins, making things better. And businessmen are definitely feeling this. And consumers, I think, will start feeling it as well. For example, consumers for health insurance. Doctors might start feeling it. But this is all little things at the edges, picking away at the regulatory state. You know, good. But nothing revolutionary, nothing dramatic, no draining of the swamp here, nothing substantive or significant. This is relatively minor stuff in more generally. All right. So that's a positive for the Trump administration. Well, let's couple this with a negative. All right, this is just out of, I mean, this should really be from the Onion, right? This headline, I don't know how to categorize it. I mean, it's so crazy. It's so really nutty that, you know, how do you make heads or tails with this? Right? I don't know. This is the headline. This is on the Wall Street Journal, by the way. So not a mainstream media, but not a nutty mainstream media. I tend to believe it, at least the essence of the stories in the Wall Street Journal. I don't always, you know, turns out the details aren't always right, but the essence of the stories is pretty good. Here's the story. U.S., which means the U.S. government, pursues Saudi nuclear deal, comma, despite proliferation risk. U.S. pursues Saudi nuclear deal despite proliferation risk. And it turns out that the U.S. is considering selling nuclear reactors to Saudi Arabia. Now, this is a country which has more oil, well, second only to Venezuela, as it turns out. And so it doesn't need nuclear power to generate electricity. They've got natural gas. They've got oil. But they want to buy nuclear reactors. Guess why? Anybody want to guess why? Look, they're out in the marketplace, right? They are pitching to the Russians, the South Koreans, the Chinese, all trying to buy the business. The Saudis have plenty of money, and you know, the Saudi people don't have plenty of money, but the royal family has plenty of money. The Saudi oil company is probably, in from the perspective of net worth, is probably the most valued company in the world. When it goes public, it'll probably be worth more than $1 trillion, more than Apple. And they all want to invest some of the money in nuclear technology. And the Russians, the Koreans, and the Chinese are vying to build these nuclear plants. So now the administration is you know, going to encourage U.S. nuclear players to participate in the auction, to go in and help sell this nuclear technology. Now, this is in spite of the fact that Saudi Arabia has refused to sign off to sign off on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. It's refused to say unequivocally that it will not use this for nuclear weapons, because the fact is that it's unquestionable that this is exactly what the Saudis want to do with this. The Saudis are afraid of the Iranians getting nuclear weapons. They want to have a counter to the Iranian threat. As the Iranians develop nuclear weapons, the Saudis will as well. They need to have a nuclear reactor in order to work on this. And that's exactly the path that they're going to take. And instead of the U.S. recognizing Saudi Arabia as the enemy that it has been for decades, the funder of terrorism, the funder of the exportation of terrorist ideology throughout the world, the United States views them as their ally, as an about, and this is the Trump administration, the so-called America First administration, is now going to sell what I consider the second most dangerous enemy of the United States, after Iran, nuclear technology. I mean, I couldn't, I don't know what to say. Now, let me just say this. If Obama had proposed this, Republicans would be going apoplectic. All the people, all the people who think Islam is the biggest threat to our way of lives would have been going apoplectic. They would have been condemning this and, you know, calling him Barack Hussein Obama. And he's in the pockets of the Saudis. And or if Hillary Clinton had been doing this, oh, they would have said, this is the foundation. This is the Clinton Foundation. They're in the Saudi pockets. They owe everything to the Saudis. But now that it's the Trump administration actually advocating for this, now they haven't made this public yet, but they're working on it. Then I have a feeling that everybody's going to say, oh, well, I'm sure if Trump is doing it, this, it's going to be fine. No problem. Oh, the Saudis with nuclear weapons? Don't. Why worry? You know, the reformed Saudis. These are the Saudis that really believe and really advocate for Islam as the religion of peace. It really is the religion of peace. I mean, look, the Saudi. Well, anyway, they'll rationalize it in one way or the other somehow, because God forbid anybody should actually criticize the Trump administration among its fawning fans anyway. So here we go. Saudi Arabia, Trump administration is actually going to provide the Saudis, or looks like it's going to allow American companies to go in there and bid for, I can just see 15 years from now, the Israelis having to wipe out the Saudi nuclear reactor because it's about to go live, and the Saudis are about to, you know, develop, to put together a nuclear bomb, and Israel has to take out the reactor built by GE, subsidized by the Import-Export Bank, authorized by the Trump administration. Ah! Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right. You know, anyway, so I gave one positive story about something coming out, Trump, and one negative story, as if anybody thinks I'm balanced about this issue. All right, let's see. That is nukes. All right. Brexit. I'm off to the UK on Saturday. And by the way, the rest of the week's schedule for these shows, the schedule changes. And I'm sorry, I know people are complaining on the chat about the schedule being uncertain. It's just uncertain because of my travel schedule. But this is the schedule for the rest of the week. What I'm going to be doing is tomorrow, same time as today, 8 p.m. Eastern time, 8 p.m. East Coast time, we'll have a news briefing. Thursday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern time, we will do a special show live of Living Objectivism, and it'll be an interview with Bradley Thompson. And it'll be an interview about school shootings. He has an essay on that. And about privatizing schools. So we'll be talking about privatizing schools and about school shootings with Bradley Thompson. Also talking about his Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism and his Lyceum program at Clemson. So that is on Thursday. Nothing on Friday. Saturday, relatively early, about, let's see, when did we say, 11 o'clock Eastern time. I have to do the math. I have to do addition and subtraction. 11 o'clock in the morning, East Coast time. We will be doing a Yaron and Amy show. I guess the name is none of the above. Still can't quite get myself excited about it, but maybe when I hear the Duran Duran song. Anyway, none of the above on Saturday at 11 o'clock, 11 a.m. East Coast time. I will, at the end of that show, be running off to catch a plane to London. Then on Sunday, I will try to do a show, but I don't know exactly what time because I'll be doing it from London. I need to learn how to speak. Partially, it's going to depend on the internet connection I have in my hotel in London. So I will be doing a show either at, we'll see. But sometime Sunday, I will do a show from London, from my hotel room in London. And then the rest of the week in London is going to be hit and miss. I just don't know. I'll be doing shows when I can, usually late at night London time or late in the evening London time. So those of you listening from Europe, you'll be in a much better position to watch those shows. The Americans fans, who it'll be mostly early in the morning for you or during the workday for you. And then on the weekend, I expect to be able to do a Saturday and Sunday show, although I probably won't be able to do a show with Amy the following Saturday. So that'll have to wait until I get back from my European travels. Now, note that during this tour in the UK, I will be speaking at 12 high schools. Somebody has to go out there and actually confront the enemy. So I'll be at 12 high schools talking about different aspects of objectivism. Each high school has a different spin about what they want me to talk about. And then I'll be doing a talk at the London School of Economics, which will be open to the public if you're in London. They still haven't posted it up on Facebook, so I still don't have details. I'm hoping any day now, because it's actually a week from tomorrow. And then, week from Thursday. And then I'll be doing a conversation with Sargon of Akkad. I don't know. I guess I need to know how to pronounce that before I actually do the conversation, which will be live. We've already got 200 people obviously repeat for that. I'm hoping to get a lot more than that. I also plan to be live streaming that event, and so will Sargon. So we'll both be live streaming it. So look forward to that. And that should be really big on YouTube because he has a massive following. And last time, I've done two events now with him. Well, one event and one event of mine that he showed up and we got into a bit of an exchange. And they've been good. We'll disagree. We might argue a little bit, but it should be a good debate. He's not an objectivist, but he has some good questions about objectivism, and he wants to challenge objectivism. So it'll be fun. It'll be fun to do that online. So look forward to all of that coming from the UK. Then I have to go to Denver and I'm doing an event in Denver, and then finally 2 weeks from Saturday I'll be back. So I'm not exactly sure what the Yaron and Amy schedule is going to be beyond this coming Saturday, but no fear, we will be back on after that. So so plenty of content coming your way. And again, I apologize for not having, if you follow me on Facebook, and most importantly for all of you, subscribe on YouTube. On Facebook, you'll get a post in advance. On Twitter, I post in advance. You can like me on Twitter. So Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. If you click on all of those, you will get announcements in advance. And then finally, of course, if you like the show, if you get any kind of value from the show of any of these shows, and if you like my touring around the country, talking to people around the world, talking to people, if you like my engaging with people like Sargon, or if you like any of this stuff, then I'd appreciate your support on Patreon. Go to patreon.com, Yaron Brooks Show, and you can support it. You can put it up there. And of course, if you support me on Patreon, you will get calendar invites to the various events. I think the event that I'm doing from London is actually a Patreon-only event. It's only for supporters above a certain level on Patreon. So that'll be a special Q&A live. We'll be doing it on Zoom. I think you'll be able to, you'll be dialing by phone, maybe even by video, and interact with me and ask questions by video. And if everything works from London, but so that is for anybody who gives above $5 a month, will be able to watch it, gets invites to the shows. Anybody who gives above $25 a month, $25 or more a month, will actually get invited to this special Q&A, private Q&A every month. The first one will be this Sunday. And of course, the one on Sunday will, I think, will be on video. I think we'll be able to facilitate video on Zoom. You'll be able to, and I'll be able to see you. You'll be able to see me if you want, if you have, or you can call by phone. So you'll have both options, either to engage by video or to call by phone. All right, let's see. So, how did I get on that? I got on that because I was going to talk about Brexit. So this is the thing about Brexit. I said this at the time that was happening. The important thing about Brexit is that it gave the UK the ability to have autonomy over its own future. And it gave the UK the ability to become more free market, to become basically to adopt free market policies independent of the regulations and the controls from Brussels. That was the value of Brexit. Now, the downside of Brexit was always that many of the people who voted for Brexit voted because of xenophobia, because they hate foreigners, because they don't like competition, because they didn't like free trade, they didn't like the free movement of people, capital, and goods. And I say many people because I've talked to a lot of people in England, and a lot of people voted because they don't want those damn foreigners in the country. Now, I was always hopeful that that was a tiny minority, and that ultimately that Brexit was about free markets, that Brexit would lead to a real movement towards more free markets, that what England, the Great Britain would do is get out of the Union, get out of the European Union, deregulate, and establish free trade with lots of other countries, and ultimately with the EU as well. But unfortunately, that's not necessarily the vision of many of the leaders of the Conservative Party in the UK. Indeed, many of the leaders of the Conservative Party in the UK are trying to preserve the regulatory regime that is Europe, and partially to suck up to the Europeans, instead of just cutting it off, getting out, and negotiating a trade deal, not from weakness, but from strength, not from weakness, but after you've established free trade deals with all these other countries, after you have deregulated your own economy and your economy is booming, then the Europeans are going to come to you begging to trade with you. Instead of that, David Davis, who is the Brexit secretary. Right? This is the secretary in charge of Brexit. He's promised not to pursue, quote, an Anglo-Saxon race to the bottom on regulation. Why not? A race to the bottom on regulation would be exactly what you want. He said he does not want to turn Britain into, quote, a Mad Max-style world borrowed from dystopian fiction. Oh, yeah. That's what Singapore and Hong Kong are like. The dystopian worlds. That's where they filmed Mad Max. I never knew where they filmed exactly Mad Max. I mean, give me a break. This was the whole point of Brexit, was to get rid of regulation. Not to establish a Mad Max world, but to establish a capitalist world, a prosperity and wealth creation entrepreneurship. Yeah. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Treasury Secretary, in other words, Philip Hammond, right, has already said that Britain will not cut its corporate tax below the rate in Europe. Why not cut it below the rate in other European countries? Why not cut it to 15% or lower? How about zero? Zero corporate tax is the only rate that makes any sense anyway. But he's also said that he'd abandon Britain's ability to liberalize its economy to stimulate investment. So please, Europe, please cut us a good deal. We'll behave ourselves. When we go off independently, we're not going to liberalize the economy. Don't worry. Don't panic. We want to be your friends. What's the point then? Stay with Europe. Stay with Europe. You're better off. If you're going to be regulated like Europeans, if you're going to have the same tax rates as Europeans, then you might as well stay in Europe and benefit from free trade, free movement of capital, and free movement of labor, which is incredibly valuable within the European Union. But the only reason to give those things up, short run, I think, is because you want to deregulate your economy. It's because you want to stimulate economic growth, economic investment, by lowering taxes and deregulating. So come on, people. Mr. Grove, who is the environment secretary, has promised to continue farm subsidies after Britain leaves the EU common agricultural policies. Again, really? Now, supposedly, Britain has to pay these subsidies because they are part of the European Union subsidy program. But as soon as they get out of the European Union, you stop the subsidies. Subsidies don't make sense. Subsidies are anti-freedom, anti-liberty, they're immoral, and they don't make any economic sense. You're subsidizing a loser by taking money away from a winner. Now, part of the problem is that the UK Conservative Party has never actually stood for free market policies, not since Margaret Thatcher. It has not made the case to the British people that such policies should be embraced. They haven't made the case that Brexit is good because it allows such policies to be enacted. They've never argued that case. They've never educated the British. They played to the xenophobia. They played to the nationalism. They have played to the anti-immigration. They played to the ignorance with regard to trade. Instead of trying to educate, instead of trying to move people towards capitalism, they have played to the worst elements that supported Brexit instead of playing to the better elements. And of course, May, who is the prime minister, was anti-Brexit. I don't know how they did this, how they chose, the Conservative Party, in their wisdom, chose, after the Brexit vote, a prime minister who is anti-Brexit. And of course they're going to compromise everything. They're going to give everything away because she's pro-regulation, she's pro-statism, she's an anti-capitalist. Now, I mean, it's sad because Britain's economy can thrive. It's got a good educational system. It's got all the components to be an unbelievable economic success. What it needs is to get rid of the regulatory burden imposed on it by the European Union. But what it really turns out, as I expected and as should be obvious, philosophy trumps all. That as long as the philosophical premises, the altruistic ideas that dominate Europe and dominate UK and now dominate the United States, as long as those are prevalent, then no country can systematically move towards freedom. No country can abandon its statist roots as long as its people are anchored to altruism, are anchored to the idea that the purpose of an individual, the moral purpose of an individual, is to sacrifice for others. Because as I've said many times, all the state is doing is helping you out. You're supposed to be altruistic. You're supposed to give all your money away anyway. So we're just helping you out. We're just friendly people from the government here to help you be a better altruist. And of course, how can you trust businessmen if you're an altruist? You can't. They're greedy bastards. They're going to do horrible things. Selfishness is evil. I mean, lying, cheating, stealing occurs when you leave people alone. So we need regulations. We need paternalism, because otherwise people will do just horrible, horrible things. So Britain's not going to change. Brexit's not going to make any difference as long as the underlying philosophy in England is not changed. Now, I'm going to England on Saturday to change it. So there is hope. 13 high schools, 12 high schools, 14 talks altogether in, I think, 10 days. Well, actually 9 days, because I'm not speaking on the weekends. 8 days, 8 days, 13 talks in 8 days. So there's hope for England yet. Now, the other sign of hope is that there's been a backlash from what are called the backbenchers. These are the members of parliament who are part of the Conservative Party, but who are not like in leadership positions. They're not in the government. They're not sitting in cabinet positions. And Elizabeth May got a letter from them, by 60 of them signed this letter, saying, wait a minute, the whole point of Brexit was that we deregulate. The whole point of Brexit was to move us towards more liberalization of the economy. Liberalization here, not in the American sense, but in the freedom sense. The whole point was to get away from Europe, not to embrace Europe just under a UK umbrella. So, you know, this is where we are. We've got the bank benches saying, yeah, we want real Brexit. We want free markets, or at least a movement towards free markets, not real free markets, but a movement in the direction. And you got the people actually in power, the cabinet, saying, oh, no, we also want Brexit, but we want a Brexit where we take all the bad stuff from Europe and give up all the good stuff. We want to put a Glock handgun to our brain and pull the trigger. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They're not allowed to have handguns in the UK, so they can't do that. They'll have to cut their wrists with a knife instead. No guns. All right, that's my Brexit, quick Brexit update. Let's see. You want a quick one on Elizabeth Warren? Elizabeth Warren is probably the most evil senator in the Senate. I think she's worse than Bernie Sanders because she's smarter than Bernie Sanders. I can't think of anybody more evil and just yucky, you know, just disgusting. Then yucky is a good word. Yucky, I like that. Elizabeth Warren, she's a real passionate kind of new lefty, nihilist hater. She hates success. She hates wealth. She hates bankers. She hates businessmen in a way that, even the worst of the leftists kind of try to hide it. She doesn't hide it. She is really, truly vicious. And on top of that, she's not, I don't think she's that smart. She often doesn't know what she's talking about, but almost nobody calls her on it. Nobody. A friend of mine, Todd Zwicky, who's a professor at George Mason University, a law professor at George Mason University, has called her on it on several occasions and has gone at her in front of Congress on several occasions, and he just wipes the floor with her. It's quite entertaining to watch. Anyway, if you remember, Trump called her Pocahontas. I mean, not the most classy move from the president of the United States. But the reason he called her Pocahontas is that Elizabeth Warren has on occasion claimed to have American Indian blood. Now, she's never shown any evidence or proof or anything of this. She's never actually argued that she has. But it's in her resume, and it was in particular in her resume in the earlier part of her career when she was trying to get a job at Harvard. Now, Harvard, of course, denies that they gave her a job because of her American Indian, the fact that she put it in her resume. But they have, on occasion, touted the fact that they have a American Indian on their faculty. And, you know, they use that fact. But again, she has never proved it, never anything, right? Never. But she has signed her name, Elizabeth Warren / Cherokee, and all this kind of stuff. Now, people have looked into her heritage, find that she may have 2%. Now, why this even matters is like ridiculous and absurd, right? But she is a racist, and Harvard is, of course, racist for taking this into consideration. But it's quite possible, that she got her job at Harvard because she put in her resume that she was Indian American, Native American. Now, I mean, that's disgusting on many fronts. And of course, even she doesn't claim that she got the job at Harvard because she's a Native American, because she knows that that's a horrible reason to get a job. But yet she's for affirmative action. So is everybody for affirmative action, yet nobody will actually admit, yeah, I got this position at Harvard because I'm black or I'm Native American. Isn't that great? Isn't that cool? Everybody says, oh, no, it's not because of that. It's because of my skills and abilities. But wait a minute. If affirmative action is such a good thing, why not be proud of the fact that you're an affirmative action appointee or got the job or student or whatever? Well, because everybody knows it's bad. It's wrong. It's yucky. Yucky, I told you. Yucky is a good word. It's immoral. And everybody wants to believe, even people like Elizabeth Warren who claim that businessmen are successful because of their luck. Right? You remember the Obama, you didn't build that speech? You know who gave that speech before Obama and Obama stole it? Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren gave that set of ideas, that you didn't build that ideas. It's all luck. It's not you. It's society. It takes a village. All of that was built into a talk that Elizabeth Warren gave a few months before Obama did. Obama was very influenced and impacted by Elizabeth Warren. She is much more of an intellectual and much more dangerous than Hillary or Obama. Anyway, even she takes credit for her own ability and her publications and how good she is as a law professor at Harvard. But of course, when it comes to business, that's all luck. All luck. I once asked this psychologist who claimed that bosses had no ability to tell which employees were good and which employees were bad, and therefore and raises were completely arbitrary, and because people were basically irrational and completely full of biases, and therefore had no ability to tell who was successful and who was not successful. So bonus plans should be scrapped because you can't tell. There's no way to tell. I once asked him if he could tell which graduate students were good and which graduate students were bad. And he said, absolutely, absolutely. Academics can tell, but businessmen cannot. I mean, that is ludicrous on so many different fronts. So many different fronts. I mean, think about it. These academics who you know, what do they know about the real world? What have they produced? What have they created? What have they built? Now, some have in the real world. Businessmen confront reality every day. His products have to work or they don't work every day. What does an academic do? He could teach garbage for 30, 40 years and never get feedback from the marketplace that what he's done is garbage. And he knows which product is good and which product is bad. But a businessman, oh no, that's all luck. That's all, that's all, you know, finger in the wind. It has nothing to do with ability or rationality or reason. It's just, I want to strangle those guys. They're so evil, the intellectuals that believe this, because, you know, they should get them out of their offices and send them to do a real job, work in the real world for a little while. Anyway, the second part that's tragic, one is affirmative action. The second part is tragic. And I've talked about this. I did a show about this, you know, also about a year and a half ago or a year ago. And that is that Native Americans are really screwed in America. I mean, they really face real problems. This is not something to be, ooh, I've got a Native American blood, and I'm going to go speak at a Native American conference, and I'm going to do all this Native American fun stuff, and I'm going to dress like American Indian, and I'm going to go dancing. This is not something to be danced about. It's not something to be kidded about. It's not something to be laughed about. This is a real problem. The rates of poverty, alcoholism, gang membership, and sexual abuse are the highest of any group in the country. The rate of child abuse is double the national average. The second leading cause of death of Native American males between 10 and 14 is suicide. And this is the beginning. You go on and on and on. You read the statistics about Native Americans. It is horrible. And when you do the research, you realize that the answer, the reason is that they're not treated as human beings. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me. Indians in America, Native Americans in America, are treated truly as second-class citizens. I mean, there are no property rights on reservations. Even individuals have no property rights. Everything's owned by the tribe. But the tribe doesn't have any property rights. Not that a tribe can have property rights, because the federal government, through the Bureau of Indian Management or whatever, has to approve all decisions made by the tribe relating to natural resources and property. Individual Native Americans have no say on their own life. There's no economy on the reservations. There's no entrepreneurship on the reservations. There's no land ownership on the reservations. Everything that we believe is sacred about America, property rights, the rule of law, treating an individual as an individual, is not applied to Native Americans and hasn't been applied for 150 years. We have treated Native Americans horrifically, but paternalistically. So there's never been an uprising. There's never been a demand because they've always been, quote, taken care of. They hand out checks. They're all on welfare. They're all subsidized. They're treated as subhuman children who cannot handle themselves, who cannot deal with themselves, who cannot produce, who cannot create, who cannot make decisions for themselves, who cannot own property. And we just give them money and dumb them down and keep them down. It's paternalism as slavery. I mean, all paternalism has an element of slavery, but this is truly slave because we don't let them even exercise the independence. Now, they have to leave the reservation, and they should all leave the reservations, and I wish they all would leave the reservations, but we've instituted a system that provides them certain incentives to stay on welfare while crippling the reservations so they can't do anything. I mean, if we had acknowledged and accepted individual rights and property rights, basically acknowledge their existence for African Americans, for Native Americans from day one, a lot of the problems with the Indians would have gone away. And it's truly tragic when you look at them today in the 21st century, living the way that they do. If you travel around the Southwest and go to some of these reservations and see the levels of poverty, it's unbelievably sad. Now, they should leave the reservations. But again, they're incentivized not to, which is tragic. And of course, don't forget, they get public education, right? They get public education in the reservations. Guess how much skill they have when they finish that public education in order to go out into the world and leave the reservations and get a real job? Zero. because that's what the government provides them, is zero ability, zero knowledge, zero education to actually succeed in life. Some of them do leave, and good for them, but the ones who stay, and the way our government treats them and the way we as a society treat them, and the fact that there's no outrage about this, and if anything, the solution is always more paternalism instead of actually freeing them up, is truly, truly horrific. It's right here in America, right in the center of America. We many of us drive close to them every day, and yet nobody cares. Nobody cares. And the left claims to care about the poor. And Elizabeth Warren, the progressive, the leftist, the one who cares about the poor more than anybody else, plays at being an American Indian. But as she put any policies to privatize the reservations, to actually make them wealth creation machines, is anybody left or right? It's a national disgrace. It absolutely is a national disgrace. Pisses me off. The cold-hearted objectivist. I care about people. I really care about people. I don't want to see people, lives just wasted and the government treating them horrifically and institutionalizing them into poverty. I don't care. I don't care who that person is. It's wrong. It's evil. It's bad. And the fact that nobody cares about it tells us a lot about what so-called altruism does to a culture. I'd much rather live I'd only want to live in a culture dominated by individualist, selfish people. And they would care so much more about poor people who had, or about American Indians and about people who are suffering for no good reason other than, the state is imposing this on them. And of course, they have a lousy culture, but they don't have an opportunity to break that bond because of the state. All right, one quick funny, entertaining thing. I don't know. I guess I saw this on Facebook. I think Amy posted it. Somebody else posted it. It turns out that China is now trying to ban strippers at funerals. It turns out that it's popular in China, particularly in rural China, to have strippers perform at funerals. I guess it's a celebration of fertility, of the rebirth of life. That's one explanation. That explanation was that the more people show up at a funeral, the more good luck that suggests. And the strippers bring a lot of people to funerals. That's what I should do on the show. We should have strippers in the background. I bet you if I had strippers in the background, more people would watch this on YouTube. Aha. I'm going to try this out on my marketing team and see what they think. Anyway, what can I say about strippers at funerals? They're not prudish. Good for the Chinese. They want to use funerals to celebrate life rather than to mourn. I'm all for that. I think funerals should be celebrations of the life lived. So, I'm sympathetic. Strippers at funerals. I certainly think it's horrible for the government to intervene in such a beautiful cultural, I'm kidding. All right, in the name of, multiculturalism, they should allow this. But yeah, China is about to ban this so much for their tolerance. But can you imagine in America, strippers at funerals? All right, thanks everybody on that, brilliant note. Pretty funny though. We're going to end the show tomorrow, same time, same place. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and support me on Patreon. Talk to you all tomorrow. Bye.